Join me. You may be able to help solve a mystery.
Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Welcome back to You Solved a Mystery.
I'm Chandra.
I'm Athena.
And if we sound exactly the same, it's because we're twins.
But we shouldn't because, update, we have two microphones. Hopefully, they sound good. Thanks to Raven, our sound girl, basically. We had another unplanned sort of absence. Chandra, do you want to tell them why?
I was involved in my own true crime story. I was headed home on the freeway when suddenly a car started pulling across multiple lanes at a very slow speed. And I hit my brakes, but there was absolutely no way that I could possibly have avoided hitting this car in front of me. So my brain fog clears. I'm on the side of the road in a grassy patch. The other car is ahead of me. And first thing I do is start calling my husband because he's not at work and he can come help me out. And this guy in the other car stumbles out and starts yelling at me. This guy who just pulled this wild maneuver is yelling at me, "Get out of the car. My door won't open. I can't get out of the car. I literally can't get out of the car. Not only am I shaken, my door won't open, and there's a drunk guy yelling at me. I'm not going to get out of the
car." Wait, was he yelling at you to get out of the car?
He did at one point yell at me, "Get out of the car."
Because you're not going to get out of your car when he's yelling at you. That's not how it works.
No, of course not. And, you know, having this tall, drunk, white guy yelling at me, I was like, I didn't know what to do besides call 911.
Well, first, you tried to call a non-emergency number.
This is true. I tried to call a non-emergency number, but then I was on the side of the freeway with an apparently drunk guy yelling at me, and I couldn't get out of my car, and so it was those select one if menus were just taking a little bit too long for the situation. So yeah, I called 911. I let them know that I was on the side of the freeway with a apparently drunk guy yelling at me. So just as I was finishing up with the 911 operator, this guy gets in his car and I'm like, okay, at least he's not yelling at me. And he starts driving away and I'm like, oh, hey, 911 operator, like, he's driving away.
But you got a picture first, right?
Yes, the first thing I did was get a picture. I got a license plate and make and model and the color of the car.
Did you get a picture of the guy at all?
No.
Oh. Had to speak to a detective?
No. No one has reached out to me since I made the report.
Cool. So you're a detect, right?
Yeah. I feel very served. Yeah, I didn't know what to do, though. What else to do in that situation where I really felt like I was potentially in danger.
Yeah, and he might have driven off because he saw you were on the phone. He might have thought you were on the phone with 911, like, put that together logically. I feel like if I had been there in the car with you and he had gotten out and started yelling at you, I might have been so mad about him that I might have gotten out of the car in that moment, all amped up on adrenaline.
Like, I could see that
what
happening.
You want?
Yeah. I do believe that that is what would have happened had you been in the car.
Or I would have sat there going, oh my God, 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 oh my God. You never know how you're going to react in the moment.
Yeah, I think that you would have gotten out of the car.
There are a couple worse things about that whole story. One is that he was intoxicated. You shouldn't be driving intoxicated, in case you know that.
I feel like I should say allegedly intoxicated or something. I don't understand laws well enough. Mm. I'm pretty sure, based on the way that he was talking and stumbling, that he was intoxicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, whether or not this guy was intoxicated, you shouldn't be driving intoxicated. The other worst thing is that he yelled at you. And the other worst thing is that he put your life in danger. So, stumbling bad car driver, wherever you are, I don't like you. Please stop driving. So that was exciting. Shanja's car is totaled.
Well, I haven't gotten the official ruling, but I am confident that it is a total loss. So,
it's been a lot to deal with anyway.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was pain. There was disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
There was getting my shit back together.
But she now has a rental car with a really smooth ride. It's nothing fancy, but it's pretty nice to drive, right?
It is.
Yeah. So
yeah, it's a pretty nice car.
We'll just keep moving forward. Glad everybody's safe. At least Chandra's safe. Don't know about that guy, to be honest.
If they never make a decision about my car, then I'll never have to give the rental back.
Well, on to the purpose of our time here together. The episode that I'll be talking about today unfortunately cannot be found on the internet. It is no longer included in FilmRise's cuts of Unsolved Mysteries, and I am disappointed, and I will tell you why in a little bit. But it first aired November 2nd, 1988. And just a little fun fact, if you could call it that, this episode also included the story of Harold and Thelma Swain, which is, I think, one of the best-known cases from the show. Harold was a church deacon, and he and Thelma were shot to death in their Baptist church during Bible study. And if it was February of 2020 right now, I would be covering that case as solved. But the case had major breakthroughs in March of 2020, and the man who had been imprisoned for 20 years was exonerated by DNA evidence.
Oh, shit.
And attention has shifted to another promising suspect, so we'll wait and see how that goes, but how great is it that an innocent man was released from prison?
How much does it suck that an innocent man spent 20 years in prison?
Yeah, I didn't look into what kinds of compensation he got, but man, I hope he got a bunch.
Yeah.
You really can't compensate 20 years of your life.
No.
But let him live large somehow.
I hope so.
But what we're talking about today was a bank robber roll call. That's right. We're going back to bank robbing.
Wow, 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 wow. Oh
'80s Los Angeles, California. LA had earned the title Bank Robbery Capital of the World.
Well done, LA.
Between 1985 and 1995, there were over 17,000 heists, which is nearly 50 a day. Some robbers, like the Yankee Bandit, would hit multiple banks in one day. His personal record was 6 banks in 4 hours.
Not bad.
There were several reasons for the uptick of bank robberies. One was the invention of cars, which happened well before the 80s, but this article said that cars were one of the reasons, so.
If the article says so.
Yeah.
Cars really didn't catch on until the 80s anyway.
Another one was retail banking. Banks hadn't been as accessible before. They were just so much more convenient to rob. And cocaine.
Oh, cocaine. The best contributor to decision making.
Always. Make all of your decisions on cocaine.
Don't do that.
In the late 70s, after the explosive popularity of cocaine, bank robberies rose 71%.
Oh, dang.
Yeah.
It's like a self-fulfilling cycle because you try cocaine, you want more cocaine. You need money to get cocaine. You get cocaine, but you're out of money. But the cocaine is like,
yo, let's rob a bank.
We can do this.
Uh-huh.
We got this.
Yeah, baby.
And then
you're on top of the world.
It goes well one time and you're like, cocaine for forever.
Starting in 1966 and then going into this golden age of bank robbing, Bill Reeder was the bank robbery coordinator for the Los Angeles FBI office. He estimated 85% of bank robbers were addicted to substances. and he could judge the severity of their addiction by the deterioration of their health that was captured in surveillance videos, which is horrible.
It's very sad.
Heartbreaking. Bank policies were simple. Give them what they want and get them out as fast as possible. Very reasonable.
Makes sense. I'm not going to be a hero for money.
There were, and I'm sure there are still, many modes of bank robbing. There were note passers, capers like Connor and Dougherty, tunnelers, inside jobs like Hadley, and takeovers. Ugh. I just thought about a bank takeover and got scared. I don't even go to banks anymore.
I wonder what impact online banking has had on bank robberies.
Online banking? More cyber crimes, I guess. Life finds a way. Not every bank robber is a good guy bank robber, like our friends Connor and Dougherty. In 1980, some evangelical doomsdayers preparing for the end of the world placed a bomb under a gas line, intending it to be a distraction, but thankfully that fizzled out. But during the robbery of Security Pacific Bank in Riverside, they were seen through the window by a teller in a neighboring bank who called the police, which led to a massive firefight that left 3 people dead and 20 wounded.
Yeah, everything about that story is pretty wild.
Doomsday preppers, bombs and gas lines.
Seen through a window from another bank.
Awful stuff. Another wild one. In 1997, 2 asshole bodybuilders began committing ruthless armored car heists, leveled up to banks, and their last job ended with a shootout that left 1 dead, 12 injured, and both robbers deceased. I was watching newsreel bloopers with my friend at work, and there was one that was like, there was this guy they were interviewing, is about rising rates of addiction, and there's this guy who's like, yeah, my brother used to be breaking into houses and stealing TVs, and then the announcer goes, but now he's dead.
Excuse me? Tact. Yes. It's an art form.
Top class TV. But our boy, Bill Reeder.
Is he our boy? I don't have enough information yet to know if he's our boy.
Well, I'm calling him our boy, Bill Reeder.
I'm going into this blinder than a bat.
Worked with banks to tighten security in the early 90s. It hadn't been seen as a big deal before, but there were more and more aggressive, unpredictable, heavily armed bandits, not like the soft ones from the 80s.
I'm really distracted by the fact that people think that bats are blind because they don't consider that other forms of visualization, like echolocation, could be equal to literal human vision.
That's really deep, Chandra. Bank employees were quitting en masse. I'm sorry. People were aggressive and unpredictable, heavily armed, and it was causing employees to quit their jobs. So, Reeder coordinated with banks to put up plexiglass barriers, reinforced doors, installed automatic locks, and, quoting from this article on crimereads.com, quote, some vaults were even equipped to trap the thief inside the vault, which was, in practice, never a great idea, end quote. And it didn't go into detail. And I Googled this. I couldn't find a single story of someone being trapped in a vault. And I want that story. What happened?
They ran out of oxygen, I'm assuming.
I mean, yeah, but what's the backstory? Sentences became more severe for bank robbers, especially if guns were involved. Better and better technology just continued to drive numbers down. But still, the Los Angeles FBI division had mugs and fax cover sheets that said, Bank robbery capital of the world.
Wow, they really owned it.
Cover sheet.
Okay.
If 1980s Los Angeles bank robbers were prolific, so was Reeder. His team had an 85% capture rate. Most robbers eventually make a mistake. Like leaving a demand note scrawled on an envelope containing parole papers. True story.
That's a bad idea.
Or dropping their driver's license in a teller drawer before making their escape. True story.
Yeah. On purpose?
No. Most bank robbers were thought to be gang members and drug addicts, but I forgot about this. This is really sad, but it's important. In 1990, a 64-year-old man was arrested after allegedly carrying out 12 bank robberies to pay for his ailing wife's medical bills, which is heartbreaking, and insurance in the United States is broken and needs to be fixed.
Yeah, it doesn't need to be fixed. It needs to be torn down, and healthcare needs to be acknowledged as a human right.
Yes, accessible to everyone, universal healthcare for all. Thank you very much.
And to all, a good night.
No, we're not done. Don't go. I have more. See, now we're getting into the good stuff. See, in addition to reducing bank robberies, Reeder had the distinguished task of naming the bandits so prolific during his era. Since the FBI were typically working 35 to 40 cases at a time, they needed a way to distinguish which robber they were looking at. Nicknames were an easy reference point for investigators. Reeder would find distinctive characteristics in bank footage of robberies so they could quickly ID the individual, who would strike an average of 6 to 7 times before being caught. Here are some. I have a very long list. I didn't realize how long my list of bank robber names was, but here it is.
Number one, the Wet Bandits.
They are the number one bandits in my heart.
The number one bandits who are wet. They're not robbing banks, though. They're just trying to terrorize young children who got left home alone while their family went to France.
All right, but here's some bank robbers. The 123 newspaper bandit carried a newspaper, said 5 meant explicit violence, and then he wrapped the cash in that newspaper.
Said 5? Meant
if he counted to 5, there would be violence.
That's rude.
Yeah. The laundromat bandit carried a rumpled sweatshirt and jacket. The cowgirl bandits wore cowgirl boots. I'd like to know more about these cowgirl bandits. There was another 5 seconds or shoot who would just spew threats. The one word bandit.
Oh.
He would just say robbery.
Ah.
The Clearasil bandit, which is kind of mean because he had acne.
Oh, that's rude.
God bless you, bandit. He would hold up the bank and the patrons, then say, thank you and God bless.
I feel like that is the direction that I would be going in. Should I ever need to rob a bank, I think I'd probably hand them a note that's like, I'm so, so sorry about this, but I'm desperate. So if you could please, please just put the money in the bag. I would really appreciate it. I just want to get out of here.
God bless. Ooh, the count to 100 bandit. Doesn't exactly roll off the tongue, but...
No, and 100 is a really long time to push an alarm button.
But he would count to 100 and was discovered to be a former defense attorney named Mark Nicholson.
Well, somebody fell from grace.
And we'll learn more about a very similar story coming up.
In this episode?
In this episode.
Because I'm blinder than a bat here.
There was the Michael Jackson bandit who wore one glove. The Mr. Magoo bandit who was elderly and had poor eyesight.
Rude!
The Marx Brothers bandits. But get this. It was 2 men who would enter a bank wearing cosmetics to look like the late Harpo and Chico Marx, but what? Not Groucho.
The classic disguise glasses.
and they choose Harpo and Chico. What are you doing?
Yeah.
No wonder you were caught.
Okay. I mean, maybe Harpo and Chico were their favorites and they just felt like they needed more recognition.
Maybe.
And that was their entire motivation mm-hmm. for robbing banks.
They needed more attention on the forgotten Marx Brothers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ooh. The shadow. The shadow was elusive and would disappear for months at a time. Poof. The shadow had perpetrated 26 bank robberies, and Reader had actually watched him age over the years through video, which is interesting.
It's like they're growing old together.
When they finally catch them, I wonder if he's like, hey, buddy.
I feel like I've known you for years.
Sometimes the names were racist or otherwise offensive, like the Miss America bandit, who was a cosmetologist who wore a wig and was unusual because most, quote, women robbers are quite a bit less good looking, end quote.
Pegs.
More guys robbed banks in general, which meant there was more opportunity for guys to be both, quote unquote, good and bad looking, because there were just fewer women bank robbers. Thank you very much. Now, on this episode of Unsolved Mysteries, they highlighted four particular robbers in their bank robber roll call. Only two of the four cases are actually solved. There was the shotgun bandit, who was boringly named for the fact that he used a shotgun, and he was wanted for robbing 12 banks along the West Coast, but he was not caught as far as I can tell because there were a lot of bandits using shotguns. There were actually a lot of shotgun bandits, so if this guy was caught, all I have to go on is shotgun bandit. Well, who knows? The next one was John William Farr, who was wanted for robbing at least 5 banks in the New Orleans area. He would sometimes wear a ski mask. Ski masks should be canceled.
But what if your face gets cold?
I'm just saying, if you ever see someone in a ski mask walking towards you, you know they're up to no good. And you're going in the opposite direction, okay? Fade them out.
Okay. She said, secretly planning to buy a balaclava.
John William Farr had also spent time in prison in Missouri for 2 bank robberies, and the FBI believed that his motivation was more about the challenge of the robbery than the money itself, which, respect. He's like a one-man Ocean's 11. He was never caught, but it's believed he is deceased, as he would be about 100 years old today.
That tracks.
Now, the shopping bag bandits were 2 men who earned their name by placing the money they stole into shopping bags they brought with them. At the time of the broadcast, they were believed to have robbed 7 banks. Shortly after the segment aired in 1988, friends persuaded one of them, Lloyd Gates, to turn himself in, and then 2 weeks later, his accomplice, Andrew Verdugo, was arrested. Both were tried and convicted of armed robbery, but I couldn't find details except that Gates was released in 2005 and Verdugo passed away in 2014. I don't think he was in prison at that point, but I just couldn't find a lot of info. This brings us to the Chevy Chase Bandit. The Chevy Chase Bandit was a well-dressed man wearing a suit and crooked aviators carrying a briefcase who tripped and fell for no apparent reason while entering a Beverly Hills bank. This blunder was reminiscent of Chevy Chase's cold opening shtick for Saturday Night Live, in which he would comically trip and fall before saying, "Live from New York, it's Saturday night." And I wish the segment was still around and still viewable, because they had a recording of him falling. They had that recording of him tripping and falling. And that shit's funny. Because he got up and he walked up to one of the tellers and gave her his demand note.
Maybe it was a way of making himself seem
less threatening.
Yeah.
I don't think so. Okay. I think he just tripped and fell.
Oh, okay. Okay.
His demand note said, "Relax, no alarms. I have a gun and a bomb. Give me big bills, top and bottom drawer. Hurry, no tricks. I have a partner." The teller reacted like any good bank teller and immediately began handing over the cash. He walked away with about $700.
Ooh, $700.
Yeah. I mean, this is 1980s money, baby.
Okay.
At the time of the broadcast, the Chevy Chase Bandit had committed 6 robberies. Just walking into the bank in the same suit, same crooked aviator, same briefcase, Ooh, but this
not,
guy,
not
this guy's
tripping
a character.
Every time.
Not tripping every time. No, that was just.
It was an accidental.
I got the impression it was the first time, which just makes it better. It wasn't until the segment aired a second time in 1989 that a viewer recognized the Chevy Chase Bandit as a member of his therapy group named Bernard Strick. He contacted the FBI and Strick was arrested on April 26, 1989. Investigators learned that Strick was a former high-priced attorney who had been disbarred in 1987 for prescription fraud.
Oh.
Which is surprising. Because wouldn't you have thought he'd be disbarred for the voluntary manslaughter?
Wait, what? Excuse me?
So, a bit about Bernard Strick. He graduated from the UC Berkeley School of Law and entered the state bar in 1972, developing a successful practice in both civil litigation and criminal defense. But in 1976, he started frequently using opiates and other drugs, particularly Dilaudid. His addiction led him to neglect his practice, and in 1978, the state bar placed him on inactive status due to the negative effects drugs had on his ability to practice law. So he rose and fell real fast from 72 to 78. In October of 1978, Strick was charged with passing forged prescriptions on three occasions, a crime for which he was eventually found guilty. In February of 1980, while living deep in addiction, he shot and killed 18-year-old Peter Verge. Strick, Peter Verge, and Strick's 18-year-old housemate, Vicky Lehman, who was also described as a live-in girlfriend, Strick's in his late 30s at this point, I believe, the three of them had spent the day using cocaine and who knows what else, and in the late evening, Strick told the two to leave, and then they went to a party, but they then returned to Strick's apartment and fell asleep in the living room. When he discovered them there at about 5 a.m., he demanded they leave. Newspapers reported that Strick was angry because he thought Peter and Vicky were involved with each other, which was probably true because Peter was naked at the time, but Strick told the courts that they just weren't welcome there. According to Vicky, Peter was happy to leave, but she resisted, and Strick retrieved a shotgun from his bedroom. Vicky later testified that she leapt forward and tried to wrestle the gun away from him, and during the struggle, the gun discharged three times, and Peter was shot in the chest. Strick told Vicky to call 911 for an ambulance and police, but after she dialed, he took the phone from her and said that someone had tried to break into his apartment.
Aww.
Without checking for signs of life or offering any medical aid, he proceeded to drag Peter's body out of the apartment into the shared hallway and leave it there.
Okay, I don't care about how voluntary it was. That's not okay.
No. He then hid the gun under a beanbag chair. When police arrived, Strick immediately told them that Peter had tried to break into his apartment. Now, I did mention that Peter was naked.
Uh-huh.
So, the idea that he was trying
to break into the apartment naked.
Fully naked. Honey, no.
It's not super likely, my dude.
Mm-mm. Strick also told officers that Vicky had been the one waving the gun around and that he didn't know where she had put it. But Vicky had been hiding in the bathroom, and so she came out when the police arrived and told them that Strick had shot Peter. She told them that Strick had tried to shove Peter out of the apartment and then shot him, after which she and Strick struggled for the gun, causing two more bullets to be fired into the walls. But unfortunately, her story probably wasn't entirely accurate. Gotta remember, these folks were doing drugs all day. What we know for sure is that there was a struggle for the gun, three bullets were discharged, and Peter was left dead. At the trial, Strick testified that all three had been struggling for the gun, and Vicky's finger was also on the trigger when the third bullet struck Peter, trying to pass blame onto Vicky as well as himself like a true gentleman. But prosecution stated that it was the first bullet that killed Peter. Strick also testified that he had started socializing with his clients, because that's important. But he was implying that his clients got him addicted to drugs. It just seems like he doesn't want to claim responsibility for anything.
No, and if you're responsible for these people, maybe instead of joining them in drugs, you should be like, I'm trying to represent you, so maybe don't do drugs?
Yeah.
But also, it sounds like in the end, he's the one who hid the gun.
Uh-huh.
So he had the gun at the end of the struggle.
Uh-huh.
Which means that he had the most control over the situation, and he is the one who decided not to try to render any aid.
Mm-hmm. And he lied, saying that Peter had been trying to break in.
So he is very much at fault for this death, mm-hmm. and Vicky hiding in the bathroom is not, because she was not in a position of power. She was in a position of danger.
She didn't go grab a gun and bring it out. So, yeah. And because he had made the choice to retrieve the gun and brandish it at Vicky and Peter, prosecutors were looking for a charge of second-degree murder. Deputy DA Stephen Trott described Strick as, quote, a person who has had all the benefits, everything available in the way of advantages, is a highly educated person living in the fast lane, end quote. Strick was convicted of a lesser charge of voluntary manslaughter, as well as using a firearm and assault with a deadly weapon. He was facing a maximum 12-year sentence, but was out in less than 7. Voluntary manslaughter, use of firearm, assault with a deadly weapon. What? 12? 12 years? What is the justice system? Oh, right. It's unjust. This nonsense. I don't even understand. When people are on death row for crimes they didn't commit, why is this white guy getting 7 years? I just don't understand it. Abolish prisons. Legalize drugs. Okay, getting back to it. In 1983, while he was still incarcerated, the state bar recommended that Strick be disbarred for the fraudulent prescriptions. Not the manslaughter, but the fraudulent prescriptions. But he was placed on interim suspension instead. To be disbarred, the bar must find evidence of moral turpitude. Quote, an act of baseness, vileness, or depravity in the private and social duties which a man owes to his fellow men or to society in general, contrary to the accepted and customary rule of right and duty. End quote.
Deciding not to render first aid to someone he had just shot qualifies.
But fraud and perjury, acts that include intentional dishonesty for personal gain, and first-degree murder possess moral turpitude, but assault with a deadly weapon does not. So the moral turpitude came from the intentional deception of passing fraudulent prescriptions, as well as use of illegal drugs, selling drugs, providing drugs to minors, surrounding himself with guns, and the bar's report slipped in that he was the aggressor in the incident that resulted in the death of the 18-year-old Peter, even though it wasn't actually supposed to be relevant. We just thought you should know. It's confusing to me because it seems like he intentionally lied to try to frame Peter as a burglar and Vicky as the aggressor. That seems like intentional dishonesty, but maybe moral turpitude requires more premeditation. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. Disclaimer, I am not a lawyer. Ultimately, Strick was disbarred, but after his release from prison, he tried to overturn the decision. The bar prosecutor who recommended disbarment in 1980 actually vouched for him, saying that he was a different person, having been away from drugs for a significant period of time, surrounded by a group of practitioners, judges, and others who practice law. Why was he surrounded by practitioners, judges, and others who practice law?
Because they did drugs?
Because he was in prison.
Oh. Oh, that's a better answer.
And now we're going to tiptoe into conspiracy, or at least elite collusion, for a minute. Because the way this bar prosecutor tried to frame Strick's time in prison as some sort of law camp seemed like such preferential treatment. And then I found an article that reported on Strick and another lawyer, Gary Wayne Patton, who was found guilty of voluntary manslaughter after shooting his wife 3 times in the head. Again, I'm not a lawyer, but I thought manslaughter was supposed to be kind of...
You didn't
mean to do it? 3 times?
That's a lot for an accident.
He served 30 months and was suspended from practice for 32 months. This article went on to talk about another lawyer, Robert Neville, who was convicted of voluntary manslaughter after shooting his wife 10 times in the head. He was convicted to 8 years and faced a 30-month suspension from practice.
I need a break so that I can try to breathe again.
All three had substance abuse issues. But what the fuck? Lots of my clients at the jail had drug addiction issues, and they were facing decades in prison for not murder. What is happening? Preferential treatment, it's a conspiracy.
I'm with you. When you're a corrupt lawyer, you know all the corrupt lawyers, and all of your buddies are gonna help get you out of your murder that you committed by shooting your wife 3 times in the head on accident, or 10 times
Oops,
on accident.
I accidentally shot 10 times. Whoops. But we know that there is disparity in the sentencing between Black and Indigenous people of color versus white individuals. And there's also inequality in status and capitalistic net worth. That's just the truth. But the disparity in sentences that people get boggles my mind and leaves me thinking that the whole so-called justice system is applied arbitrarily and is therefore unjust. Moving on.
Facts.
After his parole, Strick worked as a legal researcher for other lawyers. And my first thought was, great. It's valuable to have people who have experienced incarceration and drug addiction be lawyers. It's valuable to have peers in all kinds of positions working with the incarcerated population. So I'm all for someone who has been incarcerated being a lawyer. And I was like, great, he's giving back. He's helping others. Nope. He was working with attorney Harland Braun and did most of the defense paperwork for the Twilight Zone movie Onset Deaths.
Oh, no.
He was on the team defending the director, producer, special effects supervisor, and others who were charged with involuntary manslaughter in the death of Vic Morrow and child actors Micah Zinlay and Renee Chen during filming. This story, it has fascinated me ever since I found out about it, because I remember watching the Twilight Zone movie and having no idea that there was this horrific tragedy behind the scenes, and something about, like, the things that we don't know. So the Twilight Zone movie was like an anthology of different stories all in one movie, and while filming a scene set during the Vietnam War, a mortar special effect struck a helicopter that was in the shot, causing it to spin out of control. As the helicopter lost control, Vic accidentally dropped Renee into the water and was reaching down to grab her back when the copter came down on them, decapitating Vic and 7-year-old Micah and crushing 6-year-old Renee to death.
That's so horrible.
They all died instantly.
Okay. Like, it might sound horrible, but that just knowing that it was instant is a little bit of a comfort.
Yeah, it's like a dark comfort. During the court case, it came to light that the children were hired without a permit for working at night, which violated child labor laws, and their parents were never told that there would be dangerous special effects or a helicopter. Casting agents didn't even know the children would be in this scene. Micah's family had actually survived the Vietnam War and were horrified when they saw the scene begin to unfold, imitating the violence that they had witnessed.
Oh no, they were there?
They were there in Vietnam.
I mean,
And they were there on set.
It makes sense that they would be there when their child is there, but yeah. Oh my gosh, it keeps getting worse.
Multiple people, including the helicopter pilot, testified that the director had shrugged off warnings and directed the helicopter into danger, demanding it come down lower than was safe. 6 helicopter passengers were also injured, but all of the defendants were acquitted. The trial took an entire decade, and the industry was fighting hard against the charges because they feared that a guilty verdict
would hold them accountable their carelessness caused people to die. This is really connected to relevant stories of today.
Oh my gosh, with the rust thing.
Yeah.
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 Wow. Yes. Yeah, they feared that a guilty verdict would force changes in safety standards and special effects, which would cost more money. And it should. It should. Three people died, two children. The slightly good news is that even though they were acquitted, the publicity of the trial did bring changes in safety standards.
But clearly not enough changes in the amount that somebody can be won.
Unionize. Unionize.
Well.
Unionize.
They did that.
Rust was not unionized. Vic and the children's families sued and received payouts, but money doesn't bring back your child. So, for Strick to be working with the defense on this case did not get him on my good side.
No. He bad guy.
But do you know the icing on the cake?
Do I want to know the icing on the cake?
Mm-hmm.
What's the icing on the cake?
He was doing this legal paperwork at the same time he was robbing banks.
Okay, that should really just disqualify that entire defense team.
So after his therapy group mate, and I assume it was some sort of court-ordered group therapy, turned him in 1990, Strick was sentenced to 4 years for the bank robberies. He continually expressed remorse about Peter's death, but he must not have been too remorseful about everything, because in 2012, Bernard Strick was sentenced to nearly 5 years in prison for a bank robbery. I found the actual paperwork for the conditions of release he would have had after that sentence, and he would have been required to complete a lot of treatment, have a lot of restrictions and supervision when he got out, but he actually passed away that same year in 2012. His family held a memorial service, and he was laid to rest near his parents. His headstone is interesting. I have some questions. It says, "Loving son,
sure.
Zealous advocate." Of what? Passionate lover of words. Okay. Attorney at law. Nope.
Nope.
And I feel like maybe his family was overcompensating a little bit.
They were having a hard time with reality, I think.
Intertwined with the devastation that he brought to Peter and his family, and the fear in the bank tellers that he held up, was the fact that Bernard Strick had a chemical dependency disorder, which is a disease that can be incredibly difficult to work through. So if you listening to this need information or help with a chemical dependency or substance abuse disorder for yourself or someone else, you can go to the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration's website, or SAMHSA, SAMHSA.gov, or call their helpline at 1-800-662-HELP for help finding resources in your area. Also, legalize drugs. Also, please don't do drugs. I find people make bad decisions sometimes when they're on drugs. But also legalize them. Empty the prisons. I'm on a rampage. Thank you so much for joining us.
Abolish prisons.
You can follow us on Instagram at YouSolvedAMystery. You can email us at YouSolvedAMystery@gmail.com. We'll be back again in a couple weeks, I hope. Until then.
I'm Chandra.
I'm Athena. Join us next time for You Solved a Mystery.